Okay, so it's a pleasure to introduce Landsleit. Is that how you announce it in Yiddish? My Yiddish is very poor. Landsmann. Dr. Feintuch was actually born in Toronto. I imagine some of you know the family, but he made Aliyah as a two-year-old. Very precocious kid.
Yeah.
He grew up in Israel, although I understand they were back for a while in Toronto. Today he teaches Gemara, Medrash, Tanakh at Yeshivat HaRetzion and at Herzog College. That's the affiliated Tanakh Institute that puts out all these wonderful books and the wonderful teachers my children have enjoyed and benefited from. In Ingush, one of them right now is taking a couple courses there. So thank you very much. He earned a Bachelor of Science actually in Medical Science, and he started medical school before he switched to an even greater profession than being a doctor, being a teacher of Torah, the two most important professions there are, the healers of the soul and the healers of the body. So he tried both. So, but now he dedicates his life to the teaching of Torah, and it's a pleasure to have him here in Toronto. And Vakasha.
Okay, thank you very much. Okay, so I recommend taking a Chumash also. I'm going to be projecting it on the screen, but sometimes it may be too, the letters may be too small for some of you to follow, or the angle may not be ideal. So, and I'm going to be speaking about the parsha that we just read this Shabbat. I assume that you are even more familiar with it than you usually are, since we just heard the laning yesterday. And the reason I want to speak about it, even after we already read it yesterday, the following parashiot still speak about Yaakov. Yaakov was introduced in Parashat Toldot, but his main first parasha that focuses on him is Parashat Vayetze, which we just read this Shabbat. And I think that the beginning of the parasha gives us a few key points, very interesting key points that will help us get acquainted with all kinds of sides of Yaakov, which will be very interesting to keep in mind when we continue reading about him in the next few Shabbatot. So the parasha, Parashat Vayetze, begins with the famous Pasuk Vayetze Yaakov mi Be'er Sheva Vayelech Harana. Okay, Yaakov left Be'er Sheva and set out for Haran. The translation already over here already says something which is not 100% evident in the words of the Pasuk itself. Okay, it says Vayetze Yaakov mi Be'er Sheva Vayelech Harana. And if I were reading this for the first time, I would be thinking that it's telling me that he left Be'er Sheva and he actually arrived in Haran, okay? He went to Haran. And then I would just expect to start reading about what happened to him or what he did in Haran. However, when you continue reading, you see that this is not the case. And the Torah actually relates to us two separate events that happened to Yaakov on his journey to Haran. So obviously, not only his arrival in Haran and what he did there are important, but what happened to him on his journey, not every single thing that happened to him, but two specific events or two specific encounters that he had on this journey. The first one is told in the beginning of the parasha in the first part, and you can either follow it in the Chumash or see it here. This is the famous dream that he has at Beit El with the ladder, and everybody knows that. And we, of course, realize the significance of this event for Yaakov. Okay, it's really the first time that God speaks to him. It's the first time that he receives the bracha, the blessing of his fathers from God. And this is very significant. So it's obvious why the Torah is telling us about this. But the next event may be less easy to understand why we have to hear about it. The Torah tells us before he actually reaches Haran, we read in the continuation. After he leaves Beit El, we see that he's still on his way. Okay, and Yaakov raised his legs and set out to the land of the Easterners, Arza Bnei Kedem. And then, before he actually reaches Lavan's house and Haran, he has this encounter with the shepherds there, okay, at the well. It says, and he saw, behold, there was a well in the field. Behold, three flocks of sheep were lying there beside it, for the flocks were watered from that well, and the stone on the mouth of the well was large. When all the flocks were gathered there, the stone would be rolled from the mouth of the well, and the sheep watered. Then the stone would be put back in its place on the mouth of the well. So Yaakov said to them, my friends, he turns to the shepherds there, and he speaks to them, okay, and he has this little conversation with them. And only at the end of his conversation with them, he actually meets Rachel, and of course, he removes the stone, and he waters her flock, and then he meets Lavan. Okay, and when he meets Lavan, that's the actual, I think, beginning of his adventures in Haran itself. It's the actual reaching of his destination. Okay, so the Torah, in other words, is not only saying to us that Yaakov went from point A to point B, but something on the journey besides the dream at Bethel was also significant. And the question is, what is the significance of this whole scene here when he meets these shepherds on the well and the scene with Rachel? Now, you could say it's obvious. It's pretty obvious. Why? Because Yaakov is later going to marry Rachel. And we know from other scenes in the Torah, similar scenes that happen at a well, that this is always many times it's a sign, okay? It's like a foreshadowing sign that this is going to end in a wedding, okay? We know from the previous parashiot, we know from Eliezer, who comes and meets Rivka at the well, and she impresses him by watering all his camels. And later on, we know about Moshe Rabbeinu, who meets Tzipporah at the well. And in both cases, the one party impresses the other party by helping it out with the water, right? And it ends in a wedding, okay? So you could say that the significance is that when we read about this scene with the well, so we are supposed to expect that also this scene, once he meets someone, a girl at the well, it'll end with a wedding. Except that there's a problem with that answer. The problem is, when we read on, when we take a look after Yaakov goes and meets Lavan, I don't have it here on the slides, but you can look it up in the Chumash or you can remember it. It says that after he meets Lavan and speaks to him a bit, so Lavan introduces his two daughters to him. He doesn't introduce them, the Torah introduces them. Okay, the Torah introduces to us, the readers, Lavan's two daughters. And it says, Lavan had two daughters. One was Rachel and one was Leah, right? And Rachel was beautiful and Leah was something else. And it depends how you interpret that. But anyway, the Torah is introducing them as if we're meeting them for the very first time. So that's very strange. I mean, hello, we saw Rachel already at the well. We know about her. So why are you introducing her as if we never heard about her? Okay, so that's so something is wrong here. Something with the significance of the scene at the well is not exactly as it should be. It's not exactly leading to what we thought, the obvious wedding that will follow with the person he met there. Okay, we also know that it was pretty complicated afterwards. And also, it's very interesting to see that after that, it says, after the Torah introduces Rachel and Leah, it says that Yaakov fell in love with Rachel. Vayehav Yaakov et Rachel. So again, we don't need the scene from before. Okay, everything is told as if it's something new. And it seems that the whole scene at the well is something that didn't exist, or we don't even need to know about it. Okay, so the Torah doesn't really need that in the sequence of the story. It could have omitted it. So what is the significance of the scene at the well? Why do we need to hear about it? In order to answer this question, I think we have to take a wider look at the story. Now, Yaakov comes to Haran, okay? He's not just going there on a tour. It's not a place we would want to go. Haran, I remind you, is in Syria, okay? So there's all kinds of nice people there, ISIS and other stuff. So it's not that he's on a tour there, okay? Why is he arriving at Haran? He's leaving. He's fleeing his house, right? Because he's afraid of his brother Esav. His brother Esav is about to kill him, and he has to run away and go to Haran. And if we look at the previous parasha, we'll see that when Yaakov goes to Haran, he is actually going for two separate reasons, right? He's actually sent twice, okay? Once by his father, once by his mother. And we can take a look at that. It appears in the previous parasha. I have it here on the screen. The first is when the words of her older son, Esav, were reported to Rivka, she sent for a younger son, Yaakov, and said to him, "Your brother Esav is consoling himself by planning to kill you. Now, my son, listen to me. Flee at once to Haran to my brother Lavan. Stay with him a while until your brother's fury subsides, until your brother's anger against you subsides, and he forgets what you have done to him. Then I will fetch you from there. Okay, let me not lose you both in one day." So that's one reason Yaakov is going to Haran, and his mother sends him to Haran in order to find protection. And she sends him to her brother, and in her brother's home, he will eventually find protection and economical support, right? And he should be able to have a life there at least for a while until things cool down. Pardon?
Chapter 27?
Yeah, that's chapter 27. But in chapter 28, later on we find that Yitzchak, Yaakov's father, sends him to Haran on a separate mission, right? He says he wants him to marry there, okay? He sends him to Haran. It's as if we didn't read before that his mother sent him there to protect him from Esav. His father is calling him and sending him and says to him, "Rise, go to Padan Aram, to the house of Betuel, your mother's father, and take a wife there from among the daughters of Lavan, your mother's brother." Okay, and then he gives him a blessing. "May El Shaddai bless you, make you fertile and numerous so that you can become an assembly of peoples. May grant the blessing of Abraham to you and your offspring, that you may possess the land where you are sojourning, which God assigned to Abraham." Okay, so then Yitzchak sent Yaakov off, and he went to Padan Aram to Lavan, the son of Betuel the Aramean, the brother of Rivka, mother of Yaakov and Esav. And I'll explain the significance of this detailed description in a minute. So we have two different reasons why Yaakov is going to Haran and is actually being sent twice to Haran. And the interesting thing is that if we look at his journey to Haran, which I said already, there are two events on this journey. Each one of the events can be paired with one of the missions that he sent for, the reasons that he sent away from his home to Haran. Let's take a look first at the first part of his journey. Okay, Vayetze Yaakov mibeshava, Vayelech Harana. Okay, he goes, and the name of the place that he's going to is depicted here as Haran. Okay, now if we look back at the two, at Rivka, what Rivka tells him and what his father tells him, we could see that there are different names there for the destination. When Yitzchak talks to him, he says to him, "Kum lech Padan Aram." He's saying to Padan Aram. It's the same place, but the Torah uses a different name. Okay? And when Rivka speaks to him in chapter 27, she's saying to him in verse 43, "Evatab nishma bekuli v'kum brach lecha Levan achi Harana." Okay? So this already hints that the first part of the journey has to do with what Rivka sending him to Haran. But even more so, if you look at the journey itself, again, why is Rivka sending him to Haran? In order to find protection by Lavan, right? Protection and economic support. And an interesting thing happens when he just begins his journey and he stops at Beit El and he has this dream. And part of the content of the dream is that God tells him in verse 15, Vinei Anuchi Imach. Remember, I am with you. I will protect you wherever you go, and I will bring you back to this land. I will not leave you until I have done what I have promised you. Okay, and Yaakov acknowledges, and we see what's important to Yaakov here and what God promises him, because right after that, Yaakov repeats it, and he makes a neder, right? He makes a vow, and he says, if God will be with me, and you will protect me on my way, and he will give me bread to eat, and clothes to wear, right? So we see how significant this is for Yaakov to receive this promise from God. So what actually happened here is that Rivka sent him to find protection by Lavan, but God intervened on the way and told him, you are seeking protection. That's why you're on this journey. Your protection will come from me, not from Lavan, who we all know that he's not exactly the most reliable person. Yaakov doesn't know this yet. But God intervenes and says, this is the reason, this is the motivation for your journey. I'm going to supply it. I'm going to give you the protection. I'm going to give you everything you need. Okay? So we see that this first stop on the journey, we can connect it with the first sort of mission or the first reason for Yaakov's journey to Haran when he leaves home and he goes to Haran. Okay, so that's the first part. Now, if we look at the second part, and this is his event, his encounter at the well with the shepherds and later on with Rachel, here we can find that it actually matches the second reason for his leaving home, right? So first of all, we said that Yitzchak sends him for one reason only, not to find protection, but to find a wife, okay? And at the well, he actually meets this wife, and the whole scene at the well has something to do with marrying, although we said that that's not enough, and later on, it all the story has to develop from the beginning. But another point that I want to point out, if you look closely at the words, then you see that... We're taking a look here at chapter 29, and at verse 10, it says like this. Vayhi kasher ra'a Yaakov et Rachel bat Lavan achi imo v'tzon Lavan achi imo, v'yigash Yaakov v'yagel et ha'evel m'al pi'e be'er v'yash ketzon Lavan achi imo. Okay, and later on in 12 it says, v'yaged Yaakov l'Rachel ki achi avi ahu v'chi ven rivkahu. And I'll read it in English. Okay, verse 10, when Yaakov saw Rachel, the daughter of his uncle Lavan, and the flock of his uncle Lavan. Yaakov went up and rolled the stone off the mouth of the well and watered the flock of his uncle Lavan. And in verse 12, Yaakov told Rachel that he was her father's kinsman and he was Rivka's son. You see, the Torah goes into great detail here, which is not really needed, okay? This information we can understand without it, who exactly who's who. Okay, but the Torah grows into great detail, and that is these are exactly the same words that it uses when previously we saw when Yitzhak sends him to Haran. So he says it's the same the same amount of details, right? It says there, go to Padan Aram to the house of Betuel, your mother's father, and take a wife there from among the daughters of Lavan, your mother's brother. Okay, these ominous details, it's too detailed. We don't need all this. And this appears both in when Yitzchak sends him and when he's at the well then and he meets Rachel. So this hints to us that this part of his journey, the second part of his journey, the second event that occurs on his journey before he actually reaches his destination is actually tied to the second reason for his leaving home. Okay, the reason of Yitzchak sending him to find a wife. So both in terms of the content and in terms of the wording, okay, this is tied. So we see here that the Torah tells us about two events on his journey, and each one is tied to a different reason for which Yaakov is leaving home and traveling to Haran. Okay, and the first one was to find protection, and the other one on with the scene at the well is to find a wife. Okay, and this has something to do with his mission or his motivation to go to Haran in order to find a wife. So this scene at the well has some connection to it. And eventually, after the scene is finished, that's when he meets Lavan, and in the end, it all turns out that he's going to be his son-in-law. Now, that would explain the significance of him meeting Rachel at the well. Because if you remember before, I read again these verses 10 and 12, which we connected to Yitzchak's telling him to leave home and go to Haran. Okay, so these were connected here. So we see the significance of this scene at the well. It has something to do with the fact that Yitzchak sent him for a separate reason to go to Haran. But this still does not explain why we need the whole scene with the shepherds. The scene with the shepherds, it appears to be something that it has nothing to do with what happens later. He could have, if I just told you the story now for the first time, and I was saying, he arrived at a well, and he saw a person there, and he asked him about Lavan, and the person said, yeah, here, this is Rachel, Lavan's daughter. So he sees her, and he would help her water her flock, and he could kiss her, and he could weep, and everything he did without having to tell us anything about this whole conversation that he has with the shepherds. So why is this needed? Okay, it appears to be completely out of place here. We don't really need it at all for the plot of the story and for understanding and for the whole significance of his meeting Rachel at the well. So let's take a closer look at this conversation that he has with the shepherds. First of all, let's take a look at the way that the Torah describes them. It says in verse 3, okay, verse 2, and he saw, behold, there was a well in the field, and behold, three flocks of sheep were lying there beside it. Now, who is the Torah describing here when it says three flocks of sheep? Well, we would think it's describing the sheep, but the sheep aren't lying beside the well. Sheep don't lie beside a well. And then it says, for the flocks were watered from that well, and the stone in the mouth of the well was large. When all the flocks were gathered there, the stone would be rolled from the mouth of the well, and the sheep watered. Now in Hebrew, okay, in the Pasuk itself, it says, take a look at Pasuk Gimel 3. Venesfu shama chol ha'adarim. Who is it talking about? Again, it seems to be talking about the flocks, about the sheep. And then it says, v'galalu et ha'evan me'al pi ha'be'er. So who is the subject of this sentence? It is not the sheep, it's the shepherds, right? They are the ones who remove the stone. V'hishku et ha'tzon, they're the ones who water the sheep. V'hishivu et ha'evan al pi ha'be'er limkoma. Okay, so we're talking about the shepherds here. So what the Torah is actually doing, it is speaking about the shepherds, but it calls them flocks of sheep. Now why does it do that? Because of the way they're described here. They're described in Hebrew, it says, rovtzim aleha. They're just lying down there beside the well. And you know, the word in Hebrew, rovtzim, it means more than just lying down there. It means that they're lazily lying there, doing nothing, having a siesta there. And really, the word contains, in the word rovtzim contains that meaning of something, of an impression of laziness and of idleness. They're just lying idly near the well there. And this whole description of how lazy and idle they are, this impression continues when we continue reading, because Yaakov starts a conversation with them. Okay, so he speaks to them and he says to them, Achai me'ainatem. Okay, my friends, where are you from? He's very, very nice to them. Achai, my brothers, my friends, where are you from? And they say, Mecharan anachnu. That's a very short, you could get a little more information, be a little nicer to him, a stranger coming here. No, Mecharan anachnu. And even more in the next verse, he says to them, "Haydatem et Lavan ben Nachor? Do you know Lavan, the son of Nachor?" And then I would expect them to say, "Oh yeah, Lavan, he's a good friend. Everybody knows him, and he's this and this, and he has children, and he has that, and we know exactly what businesses he has." But no, what do they answer? One word, yadanu. In English, it becomes two words, we do. But in Hebrew, it's one word, yadanu. That's all they can actually get themselves to utter from their mouths, okay? They're sitting there, they're so tired, they're so lazy, they're just lying there in the sun and doing nothing, and it's so difficult for them to answer, to make a minimal conversation, which, by the way, reminds me of a famous story of the Yaakov is on his journey here and trying to make conversation with the strangers. And you know the story about these two Jews traveling on a train, a younger one and an older one. And the younger one, at the beginning of the journey, they're going to a city. So at the beginning of the journey, he asks the older one, "Could you tell me the time, please?" And the guy doesn't answer him. And that's the way it is until the end. They reach the city. Each one goes his own way. And then the next day, they're traveling on the same train out of the city. And the older one goes over to the younger one, and he says to him, "You know, it's 8:30. So the guy says, "And now you tell me? I mean, what, you couldn't have answered me yesterday? It was too difficult?" So he says to him, "You know, if I'd answered you, if I'd have told you what time it was, then it would open a whole conversation between us, and I'd have to be nice to you, and we'd have to talk and schmooze, and then when we reach the city, which is actually my city, and you're obviously a stranger here, I'd have to be even nicer to you because I'm a nice person, and I'd invite you to stay at my house. And if I'd invite you to stay at my house, I'd have to introduce my daughter to you, and then you would talk to her, and eventually you would fall in love with her, and you could marry her. Now, what do you think? What do I need a son-in-law who doesn't even own a watch?" So, anyway, so it's not always a good thing. We can sometimes understand why you don't want. So maybe the shepherds here were afraid that he wants to marry their daughters. I don't know, but in any case, they're lying there so lazily that they can't even answer his questions properly. And then he asks, take a look at Pasuk Vav, verse 6. He says to them, "Vayomer lehem ha-shalomo." He asks, "Is he well?" And then they say, now here, at first glance, it looks as if they're giving a longer answer, right? They're saying, "Shalom v'ineh Rachel bito ba'ay matzon." Okay, he is well. Yes, he is. "And behold, here is his daughter Rachel coming with the flock." But I think that this pasuk can be interpreted differently. If you read it, if you take a look here, I have it in English here in a bigger print. Okay, this whole conversation. And take a look at verse 6 here. You can see he says, he continued, "Is he well?" They answered, "Yes, he is. And behold, here is his daughter Rachel coming with the flock." And you wonder, what all of a sudden happened to them? What went into their head that they became nice all of a sudden? But I think this can be read differently. Their answer is, "Yes, he is." And the Torah is saying, "V'hinei Rachel bito ba'ay matzon." And behold, his daughter Rachel was coming with the flock. Okay, that's a different way to read this pasuk, and I think it makes sense, seeing how they behaved in the previous, how they answered his previous questions. I think it could be that they were just saying saying it like they're just answering again with one word, "Shalom, he's okay." And then the Torah says, "V'hinei Rachel bito ba'ay matzon." You can't, it's hard in English, so I translated it a bit differently. If you take a look at the last line here on the slide, you can see, and the Torah, okay, "And behold, his daughter Rachel was coming with the flock." Whereas if they are saying it, then they're saying, "And behold, here is his daughter Rachel coming with the flock." Okay, so they may be continuing with the same laziness and idle, just lying there and doing nothing. And again, why is the Torah telling us about this whole thing? Why do we need to know about these lazy shepherds who the Torah thinks so lowly of that it's actually calling them flocks of sheep? They don't even deserve to be called by, to be designated by the name shepherds. They're not even shepherds. They're just part of the flock of the sheep here, stupid like sheep, and that's it. In fact, the Torah later on shows us that, I see I don't have this verse here, but it later on about Rachel, it says, it adds, "Ki ro'ahi," she is a shepherd. And that's very interesting. I think this remark of the Torah is there to be a contrast to the way the Torah related to these shepherds. The Torah did not call them shepherds. They're just part of the scenery here. But Rachel, she's a shepherd. Okay, she's an active person. They're so passive that they blend in with the scenery. They're not real. They're not real shepherds. Okay. So why is the Torah telling us this whole story? What do we need it for? I think if we look very closely at the wording here, we'll find a very interesting thing. It says, at the beginning of chapter 29, it says that Yaakov reaches this place, and it says he saw, and I'll read it from the English, and he saw, behold, there was a well in the field. And in the Hebrew it says, vihine vayar, vihine be'er basadeh. Okay, he sees, and he uses the word vihine. Vihine, and the best translation is behold, okay, there's a well in the field there. And again it says, vihine sham shlosha adrei tzon. Okay, and behold, there are three flocks of sheep, right? And later on, it uses that word again. Vihine appears a third time. Okay, later on, in the verse that it says, when they ask him about Lavan, so it says in verse 6, it says, Vayomu shalom, vihine Rachel bito ba'ay matzon. And behold, Rachel, his daughter, is coming with the sheep. Now, what is the significance of this? So it just so happens that if we take a look at the previous event that Yaakov encounters on his journey, okay, at Beit El, we find a similar phenomenon. And here I charted it out here. And take a look at this parallel, this comparison between the two events. Okay, the events begin, they both begin with a verb that has to do with seeing. Okay, in the first one, it's vayachalom on the right side, vayachalom, and he dreamt, which is actually he saw in his dream. And the second one has the word vayar, he saw, okay, because this he was awake, he wasn't seeing this in a dream, vayar, he saw. And then in the dream, in Beit El, it says, vihine sulam mutzav arza, and behold, a ladder was set on the ground, and its top reached to the sky. And then it says again, vihine malachei Elokim olim ve'yordim bo. Okay, and behold, angels of God were going up and down on it. And then again it says, vihine Hashem nitzav alav. And behold, the Lord or God was standing upon him. Okay, so we have this triple repetition of vihine here. And then we have the same thing, vihine be'er basadeh, vihine sham shlosha adrei tzon, and vihine Rachel bito. Now this is even, the comparison is even stronger. So take a look. We already mentioned that the first word is very similar in both stories, right? Vayachalom and vayar. He dreamt, he saw in his dream, and he saw when he was awake. And then he says, vine sulam mutzav arza. So the Torah is telling us, what is the first thing he sees? He sees a certain object. And that object, okay, is also, it's not just an object, it's an object that goes in a vertical line, right? It's a sulam, it's a ladder, okay? And it goes from top, from bottom to top, right? It's from arza, from the ground to the sky. If we look at the other story, it says vihine be'er basadeh. Again, the first thing that he sees is a certain object, right? And the object again is going in a vertical line, but this one is going downwards. Okay, we'll talk about the significance of that later. Okay, so vihine sulam, vihine be'er. Okay, I hope it's I put it in colors here. I see you can't see them too well on the screen, but I hope it's clear. And then the next thing he sees, okay, the first thing he saw was an object. The second thing he sees is something living. And in the first scene, he sees Vine Malachei Elokim, he sees the angels. And what are they doing? They're going up and down the ladder, right? Ascending and descending the ladder. And in the second story, it says he sees these, they're called Shlosha Adrei Tzon, but these are actually the shepherds, right? He sees the shepherds who are human beings who are living, but in contrast with the angels, they are just rovtim, right? They're just lying there near the well, doing nothing. Okay, so this is very interesting because it already creates a contrast. Okay, he sees the angels, and there he sees the shepherds. And in the third line, This is unfolding, right? Whatever he sees is unfolding in stage in both cases, okay? First he sees the object, then he sees the angels or the shepherds, and then Vinei Hashem Nitzav Alav. Then he sees God standing, okay? And in the second story, okay, Lehavdil, but he sees Vinei Rachel Bito Ba'ayim Hatzon. Now the interesting thing is that here it's reversed. In the first scene, what he sees is something static. God is standing. He's static there, right? The angels were moving all the time. They were dynamic, and God is standing there. And Nitzav. And Dafka, in the second story, with Rachel, he first sees the shepherds who are static, right? They're just lying there. And then he sees Rachel coming with the flock. And Ba'a here, the emphasis is on the second syllable, right? It's Ba'a, as opposed to the later pasuk where it says Rachel Ba'a, which means she came. That's the past tense. But here it's the present tense, Ba'a. She is now active. She's now coming. Okay, so that's an interesting thing that we see in each one of the scenes. We have first something either passive or active, and then the opposite, the reverse, in the next line, right? So what is this telling us? What is the meaning of this? There's like a contrast in each scene between the two lines, and then the contrast between the two scenes. So let's start with the dream. He sees the angels going up and down, and then he sees God standing there. Why? What's the meaning of Nitzav, of his standing there? I think the meaning is to say that to give him security, to give him confidence. God will constantly be with him. He is Nitzav Alav. It's firm. He's standing firm. Okay, this is not passiveness. This is not being passive. This is not static, being static in the terms that the shepherds are, just being lazy. This is something static is something that we can rely on, something firm, something that will continue accompanying him wherever he goes, and that's part of the message of the dream, right? That's part of what he's seeing. Okay, so the part of the message is God says, I will always be with you. So his standing there like that firmly and statically symbolizes the fact that God will always be with him wherever he goes. Okay, and that's as opposed to the angels, which are more dynamic. So the contrast that's created here, I think it highlights the fact how static God is, how static his presence is, okay, with Yaakov. So that's in the dream. Now what's happening, what's going on in the second scene where he's at the well? So here we see the shepherds. And I think that the whole story with the shepherds is there in order to provide a contrast to what's going to come later. Okay, so the shepherds are so lazy, they're so idle, they're just lying there. They can't even talk, giving short apodictic answers, okay? That creates a very big contrast with the two main characters that we will see in a minute. And those are Rachel and Yaakov themselves. We'll start with Rachel. Rachel, as opposed to the shepherd, the Torah is all the time here, it's creating a contrast between Rachel and these other shepherds, right? Like I said before, about Rachel, it says she is a shepherd. They aren't really shepherds because they're doing nothing, okay? So the contrast really highlights Rachel how, as an active person, as a dynamic person, as someone you want to be attracted to, someone you want to maybe marry, someone who does things, who's not just lazy and idle and doing nothing. And that's important for Yaakov to meet her like that, okay? So that's the first thing. But I think it's more than that. I think that the contrast here is also created for Yaakov himself. Okay? Yaakov himself, we have to understand, goes through a very significant experience on his way, on his journey to Haran. Okay? Like I said before, it's not just leaving point A and arriving at point B. What happens to him on the way is very, very important and significant. You see, up till this point, when he had to run away from home, he was hiding behind his mother's apron, right? He's not very active himself. He in the scene with Yitzchak, his mother has to take the initiative, and he even tries to protest, and she pushes him, and she cooks the stew, the stuff for Yitzchak, the meal, and she cooks the she dresses him with Esav's clothes, right? She's really taking the initiative here, and he's more passive. Now, once he leaves home, so he's on his own. And when he's on his own, he has to transform. Something has to happen to him. So the first thing that happens, which is very significant, is his meeting with God. At the dream in Betel, he has this revelation where God speaks to him. Okay, and that's very, very important. But it's almost as important what happens to him in the second scene, where we see that he actually is able to transform from a more passive figure to an active figure, a figure who takes the initiative, who acts, who doesn't just sit on the side and wait for things to happen or for somebody to solve the problem. And we see this in the Torah. It is very evident in the way that the Torah describes what he does there. In verse 10, again, chapter 29, verse 10, it says, Vayhi kasher ra'a Yaakov et Rachel bat Lavan achimo. Okay, when he saw Rachel, v'tzon Lavan achimo. And then it says like this, Vayigash Yaakov, vayagel et ha'evel me'al pi ha'be'er, vayash ketzon Lavan achimo, vayishak Yaakov l'Rachel, vayisat kolo vayevk. These are a lot of verbs put together in these two psukim. Okay, a very, very, it's a large amount of verbs in shortened sentences. Take a look at verse 10 again. I'll read it in English. Okay, when Yaakov saw Rachel, Yaakov went up and he rolled a stone off the mouth of the well and watered the flock, and then he kissed Rachel and raised his voice and wept. Okay, and then even in verse 12, there's another verb there. Vayaged Yaakov leRachel. Okay, so there's so many verbs here put together. It's usually trying to create an atmosphere of a drama of something happening, something active happening. And this really contrasts with the shepherds lying there doing nothing. And Yaakov here does this whole sequence of actions, okay, all at once. He does this and that, and he moves the stone. And he gives water to the flock, and then he goes and kisses Rachel, and then he cries, and then he speaks to her. Okay, so all of this put together creates an impression of being active, being taking the initiative, okay, being able to do something. And I think this is very, very important. I think that this point is so important to the Torah that it actually tells us this point in another way, through another literary device here in these two stories. There's another important word that connects the two stories, the story at Beit El and the story at the well. And this word is a stone. Okay, both stories have a dominant stone there, right? Yaakov arrives at Beit El, and the first thing that he does, right, he takes a stone and he lies upon it, and the stone is now lying down on the ground and he's lying on the stone. That's the way the story begins there. And then he has the dream. And when he wakes up from the dream, what does he do? One of the first things that he does is he takes the stone and he erects it, right? He moves it to a vertical position. It was lying horizontally on the floor, and he moves it to a vertical position. And this is like a symbol. Like this symbolizes the change, this transformation that he went through after he experienced the dream, after he experienced this revelation. Right, so it's from someone who's passive to someone who's active, who can take the initiative. Okay, this is just like a symbol, the position of the stone, the way the stone is standing. It's lying down in the beginning, and now he stands it up, right, and it's standing up. I don't have it here on the slide, but it's there in chapter 28 in the whole description of what happens at Beit El. So that's the stone there. But when we reach the well, the story of the well, so there's a stone there too. Not only does it have a stone, if you take a look at the way it's described in verse 2, Pasuk Bet, it says, okay, there's this well, and then it says, Va'even gdola al pi ha'be'er. Okay, there's this large stone, but in Hebrew it says veha even. Okay, the stone. It's not just any stone. It's the stone. What is the stone? It's reminding us, maybe, it's hinting, we already met the stone, a very important stone in the previous story, right? So it's not the same stone, obviously, okay? But we have already, we're already familiar with Yaakov's doing things with stones, okay? So this is an important stone. And the important stone is blocking the well, right? And what Yaakov does is, again, with this stone, he demonstrates the transformation in the, that he went through, right? Because what do we usually think? What would we think Yaakov would do if he was his old self? And the shepherds are saying, this heavy stone here, and we have to wait for everybody to come, and only then we can remove the stone. So Yaakov, we would expect, would just, you know, stand there and wait until the rest of the shepherds came, and then he would, maybe it would help them, maybe probably not. They would remove the stone, and then he could use the water, right? But no, that's not what Yaakov does. And we have to understand that I think his removing of the stone is even more than the physical strength that he has all of a sudden. I think it's more the mental strength that he has to go against the conventions of the place. Because the shepherds, maybe they could have removed, there were three shepherds there. Maybe they could have removed the stone by themselves. But they're saying, we don't do it because we have to wait. Okay, these are the rules. Everybody waits until everybody comes, and then we remove the stone. I guess they had that so that nobody should take more water than others. Okay, so that's just the way it worked there. And Yaakov, all of a sudden, is willing to go against the rules, against the conventions. That's not the Yaakov that we know, that was so afraid to do anything before, right? So he has this courage now, and this initiative that he takes, and he removes the stones. It's more than a physical feat, okay? It's more the fact that he's going against everything, against the rules. He's willing to do it to show he's setting the rules. He's in control here, okay? He's not being passive. He's being active. And his being active is contrasted by the shepherds there who are so passive and so lazy. So that I think is the significance of why the Torah describes this whole scene like this, okay? It starts with the shepherds bringing us into an atmosphere of laziness and idleness and passive people. And then all of a sudden, on this background, we see Yaakov emerging as this active person, this person who knows what he wants and knows what to do, and he does it. He's not afraid of anything, and he just does it. Okay, so that's I think, very significant here, that the Torah wants to say, so if at the dream at Beit El, Yaakov discovered his new relationship with God, right? This is the first time that God actually speaks to him personally. And that he discovers that God will be with him. He discovers his faith in God and everything. In the second scene, I think Yaakov discovers himself. But his new revelation here is not God. It's the strength and the power that he has inside that he didn't even know existed. And he receives this after the dream. I think he receives this strength by God revealing himself to him in the dream. But this gives him the strength to look into himself and to find special strength in himself that he didn't even know existed. And I think this may even be symbolized by the two objects. In the first scene, the object is a ladder. The ladder is going up from the ground to the sky, and Yaakov's gaze is upwards. Okay, and what Yaakov is doing there in the dream, when God is speaking to him, Yaakov is just gazing and receiving. Okay, he's not doing anything, he's passive, and he's receiving. And what does the well symbolize? Well, the well, it's going in the opposite direction, but I don't think that's the importance of the way the well is built. I think the importance is that the well is going deep, it's going inside somewhere. And so the symbol here is a symbol of Yaakov looking inside himself and finding and discovering his powers and his strength and his inner powers and his inner strength and discovering that he actually, if he really wants, he can control things and he can be active and he can do what he thinks should be done. Now the sad thing is that this story is a little bit different than what we hear about Yaakov even after the story occurs. Because once he reaches Laban's house, so he's more active than he was before, but again, in a certain sense, he's not the same as he was at the well. See, he's not creating the rules. He's usually responding to the situation. He's not taking the initiative. He's not creating the situation. He doesn't set the rules. Like, for example, Avraham, if we take, for example, when he comes to Hebron there, he wants to bury Sarah, okay? So he speaks to Ephron, and he makes it very clear that he's going to make the rules, okay? And Ephron tries to go around it and offer all kinds of different things. He says, no, I know what I want, and this is what I'm going to have. With Yaakov and Laban, it doesn't work like that. Laban swindles him and tries to cheat him. And Yaakov, he finds a way, but it's not usually by confronting Laban, okay, face to face. He's more of a responding type. He's not the one who makes the rules in many cases. And I think the reason is that Yaakov, you see, each of the Avot symbolizes something. Maaseh Avot Siman LaBanim. And each of the Avot does things that foreshadow things that are going to happen to Am Yisrael. And it's significant that the Avot did these things so that we can learn from them how to behave and what to do and how to cope with different situations. And what Yaakov symbolizes is exile. Okay, Yaakov is the first Av that really goes into a long exile in a situation of exile. The situation of exile is a situation where the Jew is not the master and he's not the balabite and he doesn't make the rules. He responds to the situation and he does his best to cope with the situation. That's what Jews did in exile for many years. So Yaakov is symbolizing this and he's actually teaching us. He's already paving the path, paving the way for us for the later exiles that Am Yisrael is going to suffer, whether it's in Mitzrayim afterwards or in Bavel or whatever it is. And Yaakov's paving the path for this. So most of Yaakov's conduct is not exactly setting the rules and taking the initiative like Avraham did. However, when does Yaakov act differently? When he's on a journey, when he's on the way somewhere, when he's not together with his family at a home, whether it's his own home in Israel or at Laban's home in Haran, but on the way, that's where he discovers his strengths. Because on the way back to Eretz Israel, right, he's going to meet the Malach and he's going to fight. He's not going to look for a way around it. But what does it say there? It says, "Vayvater Yaakov levado." Yaakov was left alone. And for some reason, Yaakov can find the special strength to really fight, to really take the initiative, to really face things when he's without his family. When he's in the part of the family, it's always something, he's always weaker, he's always responding to things. And that's just the way he is. But there are certain moments in his life where he finds that special strength in him. And I think the Torah is telling us, on one hand, he symbolizes the way to cope with exile, and with the situations that we meet there. And on the other hand, he knows that there's a potential, there's a greater potential in him. There's something there that will help him when the time comes to really find a much stronger standing inside himself, which he discovered that he actually has. And he knows it's there. He can't always use it, but it's there for the right moment. And the people of Israel, Am Yisrael, Yaakov's descendants, will also have that. And when the time comes, they will have the strength to fight and to take the initiative and to set the rules and to bring their full potential into being. Thank you. If you have any questions, I'll be glad to answer. Okay, thank you very much.
You have a question?
Sure.
Negative on the
You're saying that Yaakov is very, his passive aspects are very kind of almost negative, but isn't it possible he's a synthesis between Avraham and Yitzhak? Yitzhak, who's characterized as passivity, you know, of the Kedah, and Avraham, who's very active. So is Yaakov just more of a synthesis of the two, so that he has tools for every situation he finds himself in?
That's a good idea. I agree with what you say. I think that's a good idea. Because we know he is a synthesis of Avraham and Yitzchak, and Yitzchak is symbolizes the passiveness. So I guess part of the time he's like, most of the time he's like Yitzchak responding to things, but in certain situations he really can become Avraham and act like him. So thank you. That's a good remark. Thank you. Okay, thank you very much. Okay.